From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. 2 weeks after the U.S. Supreme Court found that Argentina would have to repay so-called vulture funds more than $1.5 billion on defaulted loans that the funds had purchased for less than $50 million, the country missed the bond payments to its main creditors Monday, placing it in technical default for the second time in the past 15 years. The Argentine government was barred by the court's order from making payments on its primary debt until it had fully repaid the vulture funds. Last week, the court refused to grant the country's request for an extension of time to try to negotiate with the funds and avoid a default on its primary debt. Press TV's Manuel Gifani reports from Buenos Aires.
Despite showing a deep will of payment in the past decade, Argentina was forced to miss a bond payment on Monday due to U.S. court decision favoring the so-called vulture funds. It is a critical moment for the country's economy.
According to the contract, if Argentina doesn't pay until today, it triggers the technical default. This event means the country has just 30 days more to definitely settle the situation before facing the sanctions and penalty.
After this event, Argentina becomes a totally disregarded market for investments and loses access to any international funding mechanisms. Due to the country's record of economic woes in the past years, specialists say it might also lose sight of economic recovery in this default situation.
When a country loses access to funding mechanisms, it faces hardships in financing all sorts of investments. For instance, Argentina has just found one of the world's largest reserves of oil and shale gas. Without financing, it won't be able to drill it.
U.S. District Judge Thomas Grisa turned down Argentina's request for more time to negotiate and ignored its will to reach an agreement with the holdouts. Economy Minister Axel Kicillof called it a sophisticated manner to bring a developing country down to its knees. Many countries support this point of view.
Ecuador has no problems whatsoever with its debt, but we have dignity and solidarity to the Argentinian people for what it's facing because of a U.S. court decision.
Many financial and economic analysts have been calling this case an extortion by hedge funds, which was also endorsed by the U.S. Justice Intransigence. According to them, the U.S. High Court should be held responsible for threatening both current and future debt restructuring processes of many developing economies around the world. Manuel Gifoni, Press TV, Buenos Aires.
Fighting resumed in earnest in the eastern part of Ukraine early Tuesday, with the Ukrainian military firing artillery shells into the city of Slavyansk shortly after President Petro Poroshenko ended a 10-day ceasefire. Ukraine's mainly Russian-speaking parts in the east have witnessed deadly clashes between pro-Russian activists and the Ukrainian army since the Kiev government launched military operations in mid-April in a bid to crush the protests. Kiev has intensified its violent attacks in the east after Donetsk and Lugansk regions held local referenda in which their residents voted overwhelmingly in favor of independence from Ukraine. Russian President Vladimir Putin blamed the current turmoil in the country on its newly elected president and his sponsors in the West. Putin also criticized the U.S. for attempting to turn the planet into what he called a global barracks. Putin made the remarks during a meeting with the diplomatic service, including Russian ambassadors, at the foreign ministry in Moscow Tuesday. We will bring you those remarks later in this newscast. Hours after the announcement that the bodies of three missing Israeli teenagers were found, Israel launched a massive airstrike on the Gaza Strip, hitting 34 targets, which the Israeli military said were terror-related. And in the West Bank city of Jenin, at least one Palestinian was killed by Israeli troops. A number of senior Israeli officials, including the Minister for Military Affairs, blamed the killing of the teenagers on the Islamic Hamas movement. Hamas, for its part, has denied any involvement in the case. On Tuesday, addressing mourners at a funeral service for the three youths, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said, quote, "Murderers whose cruelty has no bounds did not bat an eye when they violated the ancient command, do not lay a hand on the young," closed quote. His comments were amplified by Israeli Foreign Minister Avigdor Lieberman, who called for more major air and ground military operations against the besieged Gaza Strip. Calling for a repeat of Defensive Shield 2, Israel's onslaught in the West Bank during the second round of the Palestinian Intifada. Tuesday also saw the lifting of a gag order on an emergency call that was reportedly placed by one of the kidnapped teenagers on the evening of his disappearance on June 12th. Staffers at the Judea and Samaria District Hotline thought the kidnapping call was a prank and did not follow up for hours. Police procedures require that, in such cases, officers check whether the phone number from where the call was placed is on a police blacklist. If not, the call is to be taken at face value. But that apparently did not happen. A committee investigating the conduct of the operators of the emergency hotline the night of the kidnapping found that there was a, quote, severe failure of conduct, close quote. As a result of the findings, Police Commissioner Yohanan Danino immediately dismissed some officers involved in the incident, among them the chief operations officer and the head of the command and control center. Neither will be permitted to serve in any position of authority over the next 3 years. The emergency hotline's shift supervisor and manager will also be dismissed, and their continued service in the police will reportedly be examined. That, according to the Israeli daily newspaper, Haaretz. It's official. The Japanese military will no longer be bound by a 67-year-old constitutional provision that declared the country would, quote, forever renounce war as a sovereign right of the nation and the threat or use of force as means of settling international disputes, close quote. We have this report from the Japanese news agency, NHK.
Japan's cabinet members have approved the country's new defense policy. Leaders have reinterpreted the Constitution to enable the country to use its right to collective self-defense. So Japan will be able to defend other countries under attack. Prime Minister Abe explained why he made the change.
Japan has consistently followed a path of peace. We're not changing the country's course. Rather, we're trying to further strengthen our stance. The cabinet decision shows our resolution and commitment.
Past administrations maintained the war-renouncing constitution would only allow Japan to use force if it was directly attacked. The cabinet's decision will permit the use of a minimum amount of force to defend a closely related country under attack. It says the right should be limited to when there are clear dangers that Japan's existence is threatened and the rights of its citizens are fundamentally overturned. The cabinet says Japan may use force when there is no other appropriate means to repel the attack to protect the country and its citizens.
The security situation surrounding Japan is increasingly severe. We need to prepare legislation that enables seamless responses to any situation in order to secure the lives and peaceful livelihoods of the people.
The decision provoked an immediate response from the Chinese Foreign Ministry. Ministry spokesperson Hong Li urged Japan not to provoke regional tensions.
Recently, Japanese authorities have repeatedly made trouble regarding historic issues and have also taken unprecedented measures in military issues, drastically changing Japan's defense policies. People have not stopped to think whether Japan is shifting its road of peaceful development since the Second World War. We urge Japan to respect the reasonable security concerns of its neighbors, prudently handle relevant issues, and not provoke regional tensions.
On Tuesday, Russia's President Vladimir Putin characterized the current crisis in Ukraine as a part of a long history of Western actions seeking containment of Russia. He said the West must have expected Russia's response to the attempt to strip it of the Black Sea bases and place NATO at its doorstep. The Russian president made the remarks during a meeting with the diplomatic service, including Russian ambassadors, at the foreign ministry in Moscow Tuesday.
You're well aware how dynamic international developments are. The situation is developing very fast, and not all of them are positive. There are more and more conflicts, and old conflicts are spreading up again. Very often we face them in
and in surprised ways. And unfortunately, we see that international law fails and that simple rules of conduct fail, and so the principle of lawlessness prevails. That's what we see in Ukraine. The events which were provoked in Ukraine are the symbol of the policy of containment. And so these policies goes down to decades back, and that containment policy has not stopped after the end of the Cold War. As you saw in Ukraine, our compatriots found themselves under threat. It's Russians and people of other ethnic groups, their language and their rights that are guaranteed by European conventions. These are Russian-speaking people. These are people who feel themselves as part of the great Russian world. It's not ethnic Russians necessarily, but those who feel themselves as Russians. So what kind of response did our Western partners expect from us, given the developments in Ukraine? Of course, we had no right to leave Crimeans and people in Sevastopol in the lurch to the mercy of radicals and nationalists. We didn't want our access to the Black Sea restricted. We didn't want the city of Sevastopol and the coast of Crimea be occupied by NATO forces, and so that there would be a drastic shift in terms of the status quo and the balance of power in the Black Sea. So we don't want all of the achievements by the Russian in Russian history, starting from Peter the Great, to be undone. Russia will promote the interests of Russians and will protect the interests of Russians using economic, political and any other means, humanitarian operations including, and also the right for self-defense. I'd like to underline that what happened in Ukraine is the culmination of a negative trends in international affairs, and that has been accumulated over the past several years. So we have warned in advance about that, and our forecasts are coming true, and you've heard about the latest attempts to restore peace in Ukraine, and of course the staff of the foreign ministry and the foreign minister have taken an active role in securing peace. You've heard about multiple conferences and negotiations. Unfortunately, President Poroshenko took the decision to resume the military operation. And we were not able, but when I say we, it's me and my counterparts in the West. We have not been able to persuade him that the road to a long and lasting peace cannot lie through a war. And today, to Mr. Poroshenko, never didn't have anything to do with the previous military orders, but now he's taken up the full responsibility for the continuation of this military campaign. We have not been able to voice the plan that we agreed between the four counterparts, France, Germany, Ukraine and Russia, the declaration on the necessity to preserve peace after the ceasefire was declared. The substantive negotiations never started. There was just an ultimatum on disarmament. That was good enough. I mean, the declaration of ceasefire, but that's not enough to settle the situation, to arrive at a lasting solution. So what about the Constitution? It was declared, but it was never discussed. There are still debates inside Ukraine.
whether it's good or bad, but no one consulted the east of Ukraine on the constitution. Of course, it's the domestic affairs of Ukraine, and we regret that people are dying, and it's the civilian population that are dying, and you're well aware that the number of refugees that have crossed the Russian border is growing, and of course we'll extend all the assistance. But it's unacceptable when journalists are killed, and I reminded President Poroshenko about that yesterday. As I see it, the representatives of the media, both foreign and Russian journalists, are being targeted. Who is afraid of objective information being spread? It's those who commit crimes. And we very much hope that the statements about from the Kyiv authorities on the investigation will be implemented. There are more and more regions in the world where we see turbulent developments. It's Europe, the Middle East, Asia, the Asia-Pacific, Africa.
Проявляются системные дисбалансы в мировой экономике, финансах, в торговле.
Systemic disbalances in trade, finances. We see that more on spiritual values are being eroded.
Остаются сомнения в том, что
однополярная модель мирового устройства не состоялась. Народы и страны громче самим определять свою судьбу, сохранять people свою want to determine their path for the future themselves. They want to keep their cultural identity, and that runs counter to attempt by some countries to preserve their dominance in the defense, in ideology, in politics, in finance.
Россию в последние два десятилетия наши
past 2 years, our partners have convinced us that they have good intentions, that they want to preserve cooperation, but they have expanded NATO, they've moved their political borders closer to Russia's borders. And when we pose legitimate questions to them, do you want to discuss this with us? They said, it's none of your business. There are still those who talk that they're exceptional. They don't like Russia's independent policy. And events in Ukraine prove that. And the model that is perverse with double standards doesn't work. But I still believe that pragmatism will prevail. We need to get rid of ambitions from attempts to build a world garrison and to impose common rules of conduct and rules of behavior. We need to build a world based on mutual respect, on mutual consideration of interests. Every country can be different. Every country can build a society, a world which is different. In its foreign policy, Russia has consistently pursued cooperation, has promoted for cooperation, for compromises, and not for confrontation. We urge for the fact that international law should be equal to everyone and should not be used discriminately to service the interests of individual states, and it should also be interpreted in one fashion. You shouldn't interpret it in one way today and in a completely different way tomorrow, just to suit someone's interests. You cannot unify world development, but you need to find points of convergence. We need to see not just competitors in each other, but also partners. We need to build cooperation between the countries, between integration structures. That was our basic assumption. That's what we proceeded from when we promoted our cooperation in the CIS, developing mutually acceptable cooperation, trade trade ties. This is a priority in Russia's foreign policy, and it's a long-term policy. The driving force behind the Eurasian Integration Union is the troika of Russia, Belarus, and Kazakhstan. The deal signed on May the 25th marks a landmark stage. We are creating a new area which will be appealing for investors. We are creating a common market. And of course, the CIS countries are very much interested in joining it, and I very much hope that Armenia will join us very soon. Our negotiations with Kyrgyzstan are at an advanced stage. We are open to other countries as well. By promoting this Eurasian integration process, we do not isolate ourselves from the rest of the world. We are prepared to negotiate prospects for free trade zones with individual countries and with regional organizations, with the EU in particular. Europe is a key strategic partner. We want to find new ways to expand our trade ties and investment opportunities. We need to remove the barriers for trade. We need to upgrade our legal framework, especially in energy as a key sector. That should be a cooperation based on respect for mutual interests. But of course, we all need to learn the lessons that good faith consumers and good faith suppliers should not be held a victim and prisoners in this situation. But we all need to think of how to minimize different political economic risks and to avoid different force majeures. In August 2015, we will mark the 40-year anniversary of the final acts of the OSCE. This anniversary not only gives us an opportunity to go back to the founding principles of our cooperation on the continent, but also we need to ensure that they are part of the European policy, that they are effective. We need to make sure that there are no unconstitutional coup on the European continent. There are no interference from the outside. There is no promotion of radical and neo-Nazi forces. We all need some safety net so that there's no repeat of the Iraq, of Libya, of the Syrian scenario, and also the Ukrainian. This shouldn't become a contagion that would spread around Europe. It's especially dangerous for the post-Soviet countries because these countries are fragile politically, economically. They don't have a stable, sustainable political system. So it's crucial to respect the constitutional foundation of these countries. So why is it important generally, not just in the CIS countries, but in Europe as a whole? Because even in the countries of Eastern and Western Europe, where seemingly things are okay, there are a lot of hidden ethnic and social differences which could escalate, which could give rise to extremism, and could be used, exploited by external forces. They could rock the boat and could lead to the toppling of the government in an illegal way, and then we could all see the negative ramifications. We need to provide guarantees of indivisible security. We need to respect each other. This should be the foundation. And from that, we could proceed to building a common humanitarian culture, economic space from the Atlantic to the Pacific Ocean. I talked about that as a single common space from Lisbon to Vladivostok. And I urged the Foreign Ministry to come up with recommendations to implement this concept. Our main goal is to use the main principle of non-interference and to
put it inside the European policy framework. We need to increase our cooperation with the Asian countries and to focus more on the Asia-Pacific. Of course, that will help us to develop the Far East and Siberia. The policy of Russia in the Asia-Pacific should be built on the protection of our eastern borders, on ensuring the stability in the region. And Russia will chair the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, and in the summer of June 2015, we will host in the city of Ufa the summits of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization and BRICS. We need to increase our cooperation with China. We are seeing a close diplomatic duo between Russia and China. We both share the same opinions on a variety of diplomatic situations. We are not cooperating against someone. We are not building any blocks. It's a vivid example of a very productive cooperation based on mutual respect and cooperation.
Earlier this month, a settlement was finally reached in New York City that will award five no longer young black men $40 million after they spent between 7 and 13 years in prison for a crime they did not commit. Black Agenda Radio's Glenn Ford has more.
25 years ago, the Central Park Five, Raymond Santana, Antoine McRae, Yusef Salaam, Kevin Richardson, and Carrie Wise, were almost universally described in the media in animalistic terms. They were a wolf pack that had gone wilding on a mad rampage of lust and brutality, raping a 28-year-old white jogger and beating her almost to death. The cops, experts at psychological operations against black teenagers, coerced confessions from the 14, 15, and 16-year-olds, and they were convicted in 1990. Miraculously, in 2002, the real perpetrator, a total stranger to the young men, confessed to having committed the crime all by himself. Forensic science confirmed his guilt, and the convictions were vacated. Having lost that which could never be reclaimed, their youth, the Central Park Five sued the police and prosecutors for false arrest, malicious prosecution, and a racially motivated conspiracy to deprive them of their civil rights. But official New York was unrepentant. The billionaire mayor, Michael Bloomberg, insisted that the city had violated no one's rights. The five black and Hispanic men should just go on about their lives and be grateful that they were no longer officially branded as brutal rapists. The police had acted in good faith. Only a morally depraved, irredeemable racist would use the term good faith to describe the treatment accorded to the Central Park Five. In a sane, non-racist society, the fact that five innocent children had been made to confess to a horrible crime that they did not commit would be viewed as a prima facie case of police misconduct. The onus would be on law enforcement to explain how such multiple miscarriages of justice could have happened in the absence of unlawful behavior by the police. But in America, white supremacy means never having to say you're sorry in any meaningful way, and never relinquishing the authority to behave in exactly the same manner the next time it suits your purposes. Thus, Mayor Bill de Blasio's decision to accept a $40 million settlement for the unspeakable crimes committed against the Central Park Five is more controversial in white society than Mayor Bloomberg's abject refusal to atone at all. It's not that $40 million will break the city's budget. New York paid out more than $700 million in settlements or awards from lawsuits for negligence, police abuse, and property damage in 2012, and expects to pay more than $800 million a year by 2016. But what they refuse to give up is the right to whip up racial hysteria at will, to treat black children like wolves and other species of wild animals, to scream that black bucks are running amok. The war against blacks is a permanent feature of social control in the United States. Although the Central Park Five were exonerated and will now be monetarily compensated, their ordeal bore ample fruit for the white supremacist state. In the wake of the fictitious Wilding, Mayors Rudolph Giuliani and Michael Bloomberg were enabled to impose an even harsher, racially selective police state on black and brown neighborhoods all across the city, ruining countless young lives. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.